The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Oregon's Measure 110, the Drug Addiction Treatment and Recovery Act, was approved by Oregon voters overwhelmingly in the November 2020 general election. To find out how implementation of the act is going, I spoke with community activist Ron Williams. He's the outreach coordinator for the Health Justice Recovery Alliance.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me today. My name is Ron Williams. I'm the director of outreach for the Health Justice Recovery Alliance here in Oregon. I'm also one of the co-chairs of the ballot measure 110 Oversight and Accountability Council, and our job is to implement the law as the voters intended. In terms of the Oversight and Accountability Council, we're responsible for developing the rules and requirements for the access to care grants, increasing access to care grants, and also for the behavioral health resource networks that are part of the law, which are networks of organizations that come together to provide services in each county throughout Oregon, according to the law. And those services are harm reduction, low barrier treatment, housing, and peer support services. Probably also want to mention that I'm a person in long-term recovery, which to me means I've been alcohol and drug-free for going on 22 years. I started off homeless and jobless back in the late 90s and was able to, through kind of a commitment to service, spiritual growth, and personal development, change my life for the better. And that's led to my becoming a community organizer focused on recovery issues. I'm one of the people that founded the National Recovery Movement and Faces and Voices of Recovery in Washington, D.C., a national advocacy organization that deals with stigma and discrimination and laws as it relates to people who have substance use issues. And I've been a community organizer working on everything from homelessness to police accountability and other issues in Oregon for the past 20 years. Right, so the Health Justice Recovery Alliance was formed shortly after the law was passed. And we came together for the sole purpose of working with the key stakeholders and key stakeholders in the state doing community engagement, community education, and stakeholder engagement, community education and stakeholder engagement. And our sole purpose is to do advocacy on implementation to ensure that the law is implemented as the voters intended, on time, and in an effective, meaningful, and fully funded way. And currently, we have a staff of 5 people. I'm the director of outreach. Tara Hurst is our executive director. We have Claudia Black as our government relations person. We have a coalition director, Sammy Alloy, and we also have a media consultant, media relations person, Devin Downey Smith. In addition to that, we have a coalition of over 75 organizations from all over the state, everything from ACL, the American Civil Liberties Union, Partnership for Safety and Justice, Central City Concern, Oregon Council for Behavioral Health. I mean, it's a pretty extensive list of organizations that partner with us and meet with us on a weekly basis. We have a policy table of about 30 organizations that have been meeting with us weekly since the law was implemented. We initially had 3 policy tables, a steering committee, a criminal justice policy table, and a health services policy table, but that's been collapsed into 1 policy table that has an average of about 30 people meeting every week and sometimes more than that. And we've been advocating with the governor's office, the legislature, the Oregon Health Authority, local public safety coordinating councils, county commissions, opiate task force groups all over the state. We've been actively engaged in community education and letting people know how the law works what Senate Bill 755, what the changes were, and specifically how communities are going to benefit from this law. and how organizations that provide these services can participate in providing the services to make sure that people in Oregon get their needs met, that get the services that they were promised by the law. And so the Health Justice Recovery Alliance is we're going to be around for a while. We're going to continue to do the work of advocating for full effective and fully funded implementation. And I'm trying to think if there's anything else I need to add to that. Yeah, we're not going anywhere. We're going to continue to keep our foot on the gas and keep pushing forward to make sure that the Oregon voters get what they asked for.
I've seen some rather one-sided coverage of Measure 110 over the last couple of months. It strikes me, at least, that they're certainly not covering. They're certainly not providing much of the story. I mean, the arrest numbers you mentioned, for instance, I see that as a success.
Yes.
Some of the district attorneys and cops were spinning that as it's a failure because we're not arresting enough people. Well, the point was to stop arresting so many people.
Okay.
You mentioned the citation hotline. That we don't have enough people using this thing. This citation hotline that's just been implemented, has just been rolling out, and is barely more than a couple of months old. Oh, it isn't in widespread use yet. Gosh, I wonder why. But that point wasn't being made. I mean, went through, looked back, and realized they did actually speak to one person who was a supporter of Measure 110, along with a laundry list of the usual suspects of opponents. I mean,
right.
Sorry, go ahead.
That's the story that's not getting out, is that, you know, we've already, the Oversight and Accountability Council and the advocacy of the Health Justice Recovery Alliance, we've already gotten services up and running. And what's not being talked about in the media are the organizations that are providing services with Measure 110 funds. For example, Bridges to Change, an addiction recovery service provider that is in multiple counties, was set to close its doors in Wasco County, but Measure 110 funds kept them open, and they were able to provide 150 days of safe, affordable housing for 20 community members, you know, who are pursuing recovery. And they were able to also keep their walk-in center open and help 30 additional people. The Oregon-Washington Health Network recently opened three new drop-in peer centers, one in Pendleton, Hermiston, and Milton Freewater, offering low-access recovery services. The Fresh Out Community-Based Reentry Program, which helps underserved and underserved African-American populations who are transitioning from prison back to society, has helped over 200 people since June with Measure 110 funds, providing vital supports like rental assistance and job training. There's a community outreach through Radical Empowerment of Lane County has been able to dramatically ramp up their efforts in Lane County, providing peer support and overdose prevention services. And since receiving their grant in June, they've been able to increase their street outreach from four times a month to four times a week. And they've conducted outreach to rural areas of the county and helped over 550 people so far. And so these are the stories that aren't getting out. And this is the stuff that people need to know about.
And do you have any closing thoughts for the listeners? Again, folks, we're speaking with Ron Williams, He's Outreach Director for the Oregon Health Justice Recovery Alliance and a member of the Oregon Health Authority's Measure 110 Oversight and Accountability Council.
No, I would just let people know that, you know, the work is moving forward. There's been a lot of progress made. The Oversight and Accountability Council has done a great deal of work. They've made significant progress. And the Health Justice Recovery Alliance is going to continue to do its advocacy to make sure the Oregon that the voters of Oregon get what they were promised. And that just keep in mind that it's still early in the process, that we just got the $30 million out in June and July. And so it's still early in that process. And the behavioral health resource networks are going to be up and running probably April or May. And so it's still very early. So it would probably most likely be best to start really tracking the effectiveness of that in 2022 or late 2022, 2023, We're still very early in the process. I just want people to be aware of that. It takes a big lift to do system change. And that's what we're trying to do here. We're doing a paradigm shift. We're doing the system change. And we're pushing up against entrenched bureaucracies that have been doing things a certain way for a very long time. What we are, what this work is and what this law is, it's a disruption to the status quo. And that takes a heavy lift. And we can use your support in any way. Go to our website, go to our Facebook, our Instagram, and support us in any way you can. You know, we'll be there'll be opportunities for folks to provide public comment. There'll be opportunities for folks to engage in community forums, town halls with us, where we bring people together with decision makers so that they can hear directly from the people. And so that's the sort of thing to pay attention to going forward.
That was from a conversation with Ron Williams. He's a longtime community activist and the outreach coordinator for the Health Justice Recovery Alliance. Find them on the web at healthjusticerecovery.org. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's turn to Canada and some more from a conversation about safe supply, safe consumption, and decriminalization of people who use drugs. My guests are Brittany Graham with the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, Ellie Taylor with VANDU and the Western Aboriginal Harm Reduction Society, and Caitlin Shane with the Pivot Legal Society. Now, BC has its own safer supply proposal. I did a show a couple of months ago with Aris Nix and Jeremy Callicum from Drug User Liberation Front. I think the way she described it was, I can't believe it's not really safe supply. Safe supply. So, can you talk for a minute about what is Vancouver's, or what is British Columbia's safer supply all about? And can you talk about that for a minute?
I mean, I think, like, in general, the line is that there's probably like 80 to 100,000 people in BC who could qualify as like a person with an opioid use disorder. So I've had quotations there for radio folks, and could get the like safe supply through their doctor who would be prescribing it. But realistically, the research that's come out since those guidelines have come out is close to like 4,000 to like 6,000 people have accessed some version of safe supply. So like Dilaudid or Dexedrine, et cetera. So like sort of the mainstream medical versions of some of the drugs that people could get, which it's harder to do for people who use uppers, but better for folks. There's more, you know, a direct line between like what people might be using as an opioid on the street versus what they might be using in the medical system. But like 6,000 people out of like 80 to 100,000 people is terrible. So it's not a great program. I think they're trying to expand it. I think they're throwing money at it. But realistically, it's all about doctors and pharmacists having the wherewithal to prescribe to folks. And a lot of the times they don't have the education or the interest to support someone who uses drugs in their practices. So I think we're going to continue to come up against these barriers as long as it's completely in the medical system. And that's why VANDU and the Drug Users Liberation Front are trying to do those compassion club models, because, you know, some people really do want to go to their doctor and get their prescriptions through their doctors, and that they should have the right to do that. But people who don't want to do that should also have the right to get a safe supply somewhere else. And so, you know, it's not a great system right now. I think you have to walk through a lot of hoops being able to carry your medication. So taking medication for multiple days is really hard for folks. That's classically something that's hard for people who are on methadone. If you talk to a lot of people in the neighborhood who are on methadone or methadose or any of those, they have to go almost every day to their pharmacist to get their supply for that day. And like methadone's like a, you know, been around for like 40, 50 years, something like that. And like many of these people have been on methadone for 10 to 15 years, and they still have to go in almost every day. So those sorts of things are going to continue into like a safer supply model, because there's still a lot of stigma and a lot of shame and stuff put on drug users from the medical system. So as long as it's purely in the medical system as it is right now, we're going to keep seeing barriers to folks actually getting the medication that they need or the supply they need, whichever word you want to use.
I'd just Sally here from Race. And from Van Duren Wharf, that safe supply in my mind, and I can say this because I got no job to lose, it's also about setting up, to me, I want to see community compassion club, you know, come in, you know, Van Duren is well known, for instance, what happened here, people come in and it's like a kind of a wellness hub, you know, even if it's just an IR or a room that they use, a using space, that there is a person there who has gone through the process of what's it called, a peer navigator, and been and is able to dispense. And so peer-to-peer dispensing of clean, safe drugs that have, or substance that have been taken, like I'm sure that Dolph has told you in some ways, changed and tested. And if the, you know, we know it's only clean because we've actually tested this stuff and then redispersing it. This is ideas we're coming up with that are fringe, because these are not ideas that are going to get funding. Okay. These are, I know this. However, they're ideas that need to be done, because a lot of people prefer heroin over OAT, which is a replacement. A lot of people prefer meth over Dilaudids or Ritalins or whatever it's given. I'm not quite sure on that one, because I use meth itself because I prefer it. I know that a lot of people do not want to have the effects of opiates. They are going for a high, or they are going for a numbing, but still be awake. So there's a whole bunch of other, if you really get into drugs, there's a lot of drugs that fit in all of those things. My point is this: only the community that understands how to test drugs, we're trained with how to use spectrometers, going through that at Van Duren, hopefully in the future we'll have people that are trained and able to do that. And we become our own, we test ourselves, have our own testing center as well there. The problem with that, of course, is it's not popular, because who wants to hear that meth is actually helpful for people? I'm going to tell you that half my organizing has been done on speed, and that without speed, I probably wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
People have no trouble with the idea of folks being prescribed Adderall, which is amphetamine salts and methamphetamine. I mean, as long as you can pay a doctor, find a doctor who's willing to give you the prescription, then pay them enough to get the prescription, and then find the pharmacy and go through all that and pay, everything's going to be fine. But if you're not able to find the doctor or whatever the reason, which again is the problem with the medical model. I mean, great idea. Find a doctor who's willing to prescribe. Ooh, good luck with that one. Now find a pharmacy where you can get the stuff. Ooh, real good luck with that one. Mm-hmm. And again,
the reality is, what pharmacy is there in the in between? That pharmacy is the market that everyone says so bad. You know, now it's the substance market that's not exactly on the books. Yeah, but very well organized.
And you know, beyond that, it's like, you know, the market has changed a lot in the last 10 years, 5 years even, and even what people are using now, like meth has gone up from like, you know, roughly 20 to 25% of people in BC were reporting meth use 5 years ago. And now it's like 70% are using it in the last 3 days. So it's, and I think that's a lot of that has to do with the toxic supply, where people are getting heavier drugs that they might not have used 4 or 5 years ago, and so are balancing it out with something that's going to lift them up, etc. There's lots of reasons why people use drugs, but when they go into the system doesn't necessarily understand what's happening with drug use right mm-hmm. now. Like benzos are a big thing, they're in a lot of things. People aren't purposely taking them, but when you're taking illegal drugs all the time that have benzos in them, it is now a part of your life. And if you want to go into the medical system and you ask for benzos with your dope that you're getting prescribed, they're going to not approve that. And I've even heard of like some of the detox centers that won't accept people when they're on benzos. Like they admit that they have benzos or they've been taking them, because they they're not equipped for that. But then, like, they're leaving that person out in the dust to figure it out on their own. Like, it's a kind of, that's the thing with the medical system. Like, if we put too much of this in the medical system, it takes them a really long time to move, because it's this massive, like, long standing institution that's based on, like, colonial history. And so, like, it takes forever to get done, but, like, drugs are changing very quickly, and what people need to feel better and feel okay and not die is changing every day, and you have to kind of get there quicker than what the medical system is doing.
Well, they should be thinking compassion to thinking legal liability. We're not set up for that, so nope.
Well, yeah, I think that's it, is they're thinking about liability. It's like, if I give you drugs and you die, then that's on me. But it's like, think about it this way. If you don't give people drugs and they go out into the street and buy something and die, how is that not your responsibility?
Wow. Well put for me.
I'm going to try and think of another question, because there's nothing really to follow from that except, yeah, what she said.
Yeah!
Oh, Caitlin. Tell me about the Pivot Legal Society.
So, yeah, Pivot is a human rights legal organization. We've been based out of the downtown east side of Vancouver for, I don't know how long we've been there now, probably 20 years or so. And we do something called strategic litigation, which is basically like, we're not like a criminal defense firm, but we kind of work with groups to identify cases that would have a systemic impact and that would set a precedent for future cases. So like right now I'm working with a BC-based drug user-led group whose business license was denied when they were trying to basically just have like a drug user meeting space where people could access harm reduction supplies and hang out and get away from the cold. And they were denied a business license. I mean, we say on the basis of discrimination and the fact that there are people who use drugs, but so kind of working with groups to take on cases that will set a precedent and that will have a bigger outward effect. And I work on drug policy specifically, and work super closely with Vandu, and kind of, I don't know, I guess I see my role as bringing some legal analysis and, legal ability to the table, but also it's kind of like, we're a movement, right? And we're all in this together, and we all have our strengths and our weaknesses. And so I'm a lawyer, yes, but I see myself as being part of the movement first and foremost, and kind of, you know, in comradeship and solidarity with people while we work toward this goal of ending the harms of the drug war. So
what questions have I not asked that I really, really should?
I think you asked great questions. You know, like, it's so complicated now with drug policy, where like, and I think the thing is, like, you get sucked into being like so deep in it. I did a bunch of like local radio station interviews around this decrim stuff, and the questions that they were asking were like, what is decrim? Like really basic. And I was like, oh yeah, like, I forget that people in like small town wherever might not know anything about this. And so, like, you know, I had to bring it back to a really like basic level. And so I think it's hard. Sometimes we need the simple questions, and sometimes we need the complex ones. So it's good to have both, you know. Yeah. Like, I think you did a great job.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good intro. It was good. It was nice to know.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's very kind. For your social media and websites, how do people keep up with the work that you're doing? How can people support the work that you're doing?
So we do have a website, vandu.org. I'm going to be honest and say that it has not been updated in a while, but we will be committing to that at some point in the near future. If you want to contact Vandu directly, vandu@vandu.org is the best email. We have Twitter, which is Vandu People, or at Vandu People. And then I don't know what our Facebook is, but if you just Google Vandu or Vancouver Network of Drug Users and Facebook, that's where we post a lot of our stuff. So,
and what's our Aboriginal our harm reduction, Indigenous harm reduction, also has a web page by the same name and a Facebook page.
Yeah, so, wars.ca.
Wars.ca.
Right?
So, and yeah.
What's it?
WAHRS. I won't forget it.
I think it's
We're in
CA.
The walls.
Yeah.
.ca.
Yeah.
And you can even Google it, right? It's no big deal.
But and they keep their website up to date.
We do. So. Well, we have a really, never mind. I won't get into the details. That's board business.
It's fancy.
I will put one of the places where I post this show, I'll put up a link to make sure people can find that. And since Caitlin had to step away, I will mention that Pivot Legal Society is at pivotlegal.org and they're at Pivot Legal on Twitter and Pivot Legal Society on Facebook.
Yeah, and if you want to read a press release on the decriminalization, it is on pivotlegal.org. So if you want more details about what we are happy and not happy about, they have it on their website.
Do you have any closing thoughts for the listeners?
I just want to encourage, this is Ellie, people to remember what I said about challenging our own stigma too, right? It's one thing to look at other people and say they have stigma, we need to change them. It's another thing to look at ourselves. And I guess I leave the listeners and your wonderful audience with the idea that we are people too, people deserving of basic resources, also people deserving of respect. And people deserving the right to autonomy over our own bodies and the human rights that are often given to other people. And I'd also like people to understand that you can simply be the change by carrying a Narcan in your community if you don't have access to an OPS. If you don't have access to a Narcan, you can get it from your health authority, I'm sure. You know, things like this, right? And I encourage and thank you for taking the time today, for listening. And yeah, that's what I think. Hey, what about you, Brittany?
I mean, I think the one thing I would point out is that, like, yes, Canada does have a lot of stuff going for it, but, like, for a really good example is, like, when Van Du started doing naloxone 15, 20 years ago, we actually got it from Edmonton, who would get it in the mail from a place in Chicago. So there is a network of people in the U.S. who are doing good work. I think it's harder to find that network than necessarily here, but like the power in a movement is having lots of voices and from lots of different perspectives, and like, you know, people who use drugs should be at the forefront of those, and empowering those people to make those decisions and be at the government side of their organizations. But ultimately, like, anyone could be a part of drug policy. You just have to have the right mindset to be there. And it's just like, make sure that the people who need to be in the room are in the room. Nothing about us without us is the general statement. So just keep that in mind and we can all move forward.
That was from my recent conversation with Brittany Graham from the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, Ellie Taylor with Van Du and the Western Aboriginal Harm Reduction Society, and Caitlin Shane with the Pivot Legal Society. And that's it for this week. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.